You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Everyone I've told about the brief is dead.
If this thing reaches as deep and goes as high as we think it does, these men will do anything not to be exposed.
Julia Roberts, Denzel Washington, The Pelican Brief.
Welcome to Adaptation Nation. It's our show where we read the thing, we watch the thing, we talk about the thing. Joining me today is Amanda Nelson.
Hello.
We're back. You were here for Dune. We had a great time with Dune. Got some good feedback on Dune. Having a good time. We're going the other way from Au Courant, Zeitgeisty, to probably no one thinks about this movie except for us territory, maybe a little bit.
That's fair.
We're doing The Pelican Brief, the book by John Grisham, the movie written and directed by Alan J. Pakula. Pakula, I couldn't find a pronunciation, so I'm going to Pakula because that's what comes naturally to me. Apologies to Alan if that's wrong.
Well, he's dead. He doesn't care.
He doesn't care. But, you know, you try to get the names right. Mm-hmm. So far we've done Casino Royale, Wheel of Time, and Dune. And each one of those we had a hook, right? Yeah. Wheel of Time is new. Dune was new. And then Casino Royale was the end of the Craig run as Bond, mm-hmm. right? And also, you know, there's sort of, I don't think it's the slightest of hooks. We're not really rationalizing. It was like, let's go back to the beginning and talk about the Craig run and then that Craig Bond. And then the book is so interesting, too, for all the reasons Vanessa and I talked about. Eric, go listen to that. With The Pelican Brief, there's no real reason to talk about this now. Is there, Amanda?
I like it.
I've got a rationalization. Would you like to hear my rationalization?
Yes.
Denzel.
Okay.
And Denzel is starring in maybe my most anticipated adaptation of 2022.
Yeah.
Macbeth. Yeah. And looking real awesome in that book, directed by Joel Cohen, Frances McDormand as Lady Macbeth. You've seen the trailer. If you haven't by now, go look at it. Shot in black and white. It looks fantastic. Denzel's already done Shakespeare, did Much Ado right before The Pelican Brief in 1992. Interesting. Lee, so I when we made our list of things we might want to talk about, I put Pelican Brief on there, and both Amanda and I was like, let's talk about this. Then I bumped Denzel up because I wanted to talk about Denzel before Macbeth, and I think we probably will do an episode on Macbeth, because another thing that came up in talking about how to program for this show, this is a little insider baseball, is on bookriot.com and our sister adjacent, all of our properties on newsletters, podcasts, whatever, we care and build into our editorial practices diversity, right? We want people to be represented at least sort of in very like broad strokes, sort of how it is in America, how many people of color, women, so on and so forth. Now, literary adaptations is a problem for a couple of reasons. One is all the structural stuff in publishing is triply so historically for Hollywood.
Seriously.
Yeah. Right? So not only is it hard to have a book adapted in the first place, especially before the great adaptation gold rush of the last few years, which gives us a lot more interesting and diverse properties, but before now, there's just not that many books, Amanda, that got translated by authors of color into movies. There's like the Joy Luck Club and the Color Purple, and like you can name them on one hand, the ones that we could talk about kind of off the cuff at a cocktail party. And so we broadened our vision a little bit. It's like, what does it mean to have an inclusive film adaptation? We said one of the things that I think matters is one of the stars a person of color. And that opens up a little bit. And I think that's especially fascinating in the context of the
past. Oh, yeah.
So we're going to get into that and all the reasons here. So I think that's another reason, because Denzel is a singular, like, there are singular figures in Hollywood, and I think Denzel, you kind of have to do a Sidney Poitier to Denzel to Will Smith, kind of the black leading, like the biggest, if you're going to be one of the biggest stars in the world, Sidney Poitier wasn't on Denzel's level, but Denzel created, inhabited, the world was ready for, a black man is one of the 10 biggest movie stars in the world, Amanda. And this is coming at the height of his first great period. He's after Glory. He's doing all kinds of interesting stuff. he's had a very interesting career, highs and lows, like anyone who's been in this business a long time would be interested, especially we talk about Julia Roberts, the other lead. But I think Denzel is the reason to talk about this movie, both as because I think, frankly, for me, his performance as Greg Grantham is the best part of this movie.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And then he is a fascinating figure. And then as an adaptation question, Denzel Washington played Greg Grantham, who is obviously and meaningfully white in the mm-hmm. book, as a black man, is a fascinating choice that has interesting ramifications for us to talk about.
Yeah, I felt a little squirrely, personally, picking this one for the next show, just because we had done a run. You know, the first three books were by white men, but Dune had a really diverse cast, and so does Wheel of Time, and I don't want mm-hmm. to act like those things don't matter, especially now, and after the summer we had last year, so... Denzel's such a fascinating actor to me, because I think that he was really on track to be like America's dad. Like, it was him or Tom Hanks. Like, these were going to be our dads, right? Yes. And then Denzel started playing a string of like terrifying sociopaths, and he plays them so well mm-hmm. that I think people were instinctively like, ooh, I don't want him to be my dad. He might kill me in my sleep. He's like so good at
it. Or I want him to be my dad if he has to kill someone
for me. Right.
If you need revenge dad, if you get Denzel. You want Christmas morning dad, I guess you get Hanks. Is that what we kind of want?
Yeah. Because like after this, it's like Training Day. You know, like all of these movies where he plays
Taking
somebody.
Taking a Pelham 1-2-3,
yes.
Man on Fire, John Q.
Oh, God, like, Man on Fire.
They're all very similar. Yeah.
And he's just really scary. He's just really scary. But he's not scary in The Pelican Brief. Everyone else is scary in the book and the movie, which I guess we could talk about later.
That was our sort of preamble texting mm-hmm. when we were getting ready. Like, we decided we'd do it, put on the schedule, and there's always a period of like, whoa, I haven't read this, or I haven't read this in a while, and what do you see? Mm-hmm. And yours was... Everyone's terrible
yes.
in the book, Pelican Brief. Everyone is bad. And it doesn't really translate that way to the movie,
no.
but I think in the book, it's very, very bad. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to get into that in a second. So why do this episode now? Okay, we want to.
We want to.
It's an interesting transition. I also think the other thing is, now that we are fully in the Grisham is background noise of the publishing industry, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, like, literally background noise, and, like, there's a lot of Grisham books out there. They sell very well. He's been around 30 years. Sold, you know, half a billion copies around the world, and largely irrelevant
yeah.
at the same time in talking about books. But there was a time, and this was the beginning of this five-year run between 92 and 97, or 93 to 98. I can't quite remember, but there's a 5 to 6 year run starting with The Firm and ending with, I think, The Chamber was the last one, where there was a Grisham movie every year starring kind of the dude
the,
of the moment.
The dude of the day.
All the rest of them are, you know, the dude of the day. Denzel, I think, because of racially an outlier to some degree, the way it makes perfect sense in a lot of other ways. And then in 98, the Grisham moment's kind of over as being relevant other than something you read at the airport, right? And which is fine. And that's probably Grisham has subsidized a bunch of books you and I care about at the various publishing houses he's been in. But in terms of, like, what are the best books of the year? What are you recommending to people? I can't think of when I would ever recommend a John Grisham book necessarily. I'm certainly not going to recommend The Pelican Brief. And now they get turned into, if they get made into a movie, it's like A Painted House or Christmas with the Cranks. Like, the legal thriller for which Grisham is the exemplar, which we can talk about too, the legal thriller genre. But, like, what was John Grisham? You know, that kind of an internet meme that you see for, like, what was John Grisham? And I think that's interesting and worth talking about too. Because I'm 15 when this starts happening. Mm-hmm. So, like, this is my cultural consciousness is coming to bear, both sort of nascently politically and artistically and culturally. So The Pelican Brief with Julia Roberts and Denzel Washington, who at the time, I didn't do a power ranking, but we're talking two of the 10 biggest movie stars in the world in John Grisham, which is now the biggest author in the world. Like, this is a huge deal in 1993. Was it a huge deal to you? Do you remember this at all when it came out?
No, I don't. I remember by the time I got around to it, it was like doing its cable run where, you know, that period in like the late 90s, I guess, or maybe it was the early 2000s, where it was just always on. Like, like Shawshank. Yes. Like, Shawshank is always on Turner Classic Movies or whatever channel it's playing on. And The Pelican Brief was on all the time. So I must have seen it a floppity jillion times. My, like, sense memory of it is watching it in between, like, NASCAR races and football games on Sundays with my dad. Like, that is what it was. NASCAR, Pelican Brief, football. That's what we did.
If it wasn't The Hunt for Red October
for
you, Amanda, it was The Pelican Brief. And I think... Now, The Firm was the big hit, right? Cruise, that's the first one that comes out, made $270 million internationally, which is a big hit, a huge hit, especially in 1993. Pelican Brief came after, not quite of a biggest hit, $190 million on a $40 million budget. also the kind of movie that doesn't get made anymore for reasons we can talk about. Essentially no special effects. There's no IP except that I guess Grisham and Denzel are, I mean, stars are IP when you think about it, of a certain kind of context, but they don't really make these kinds of movies anymore. And I've got a theory for you. We talked about this a little bit, about the legal thriller, what happened to Grisham, what happened to this idea of legal thriller. I've got a couple of confluences that I want to throw by you about why the Grisham thing became, you know, now another name, like the Ludlums, Pattersons, Nora Roberts of the world, which people like them and read them, but no one sort of cares about them culturally.
I also have a theory.
So a couple of things.
Go.
Okay, you go first. Oh, you go first. Okay. I've said enough.
I think the legal thriller took a sort of political turn where lawyers were no longer acceptable heroes. They're still acceptable villains, but the kind of audience that this book is aimed at, which is like middle-aged white men, took a political turn from venerating really competent lawyers to venerating really competent soldiers and cops. So now we have NCIS, we have the Bourne movies, even the resurgence of the Bond movies, or maybe not resurgence, but like just inability to get rid of the Bond movies. Those are the sorts of things I think this audience, this intended audience, is super, super interested in now. And I don't know that it's a like a complete 180. Like, these are very similar kinds of tones of books, but lawyers tend to be very intellectual. They often go to really elite schools. They have a lot of power. They're in a lot of inner circles, and those are, as we have seen recently, not the sorts of things that 50-year-old white men are interested in, like, rooting for anymore. So I think that's part of the reason why over time this kind of thing from John Grisham became less and less what people wanted to read or watch, or less and less what these people wanted to read or watch. And I, like, yeah, I know I'm speaking in generalities, but that's what marketing audiences are, our general, like, our generalities.
I think there's a lot to that. I think I would put that as a sub theme, or maybe an analog theme to one of my, one of the rivers flow, one of the tributaries to my river of irrelevance that John Grisham experienced, even as he can swim around in it, because it's made of money for him. So I think related to that point, and maybe goes alongside of it, is September 11th, 2001. This sort of purely domestic thriller was both, it's all of a sudden seems claustrophobic, I think, in a weird way, where it's like the threat is the threat of Victor Matisse and the oil driller seems out of scale with, let's just put it on there, this xenophobic portrayal of Muslim Americans that we've caught ever since. And we'll throw Bourne and we'll throw Bond and some of the people that have to wrestle with this externality, right? Because you look at something like Zero Dark 30 or something else like that, right? I think so. That's part of it, is this just sort of insular, there's no, the heroes here don't shoot guns, like, that's related to your point, right? Denzel and Julia Roberts aren't whipping around guns, or just not. And there is a way, like American Sniper is maybe the analog that you're kind of thinking about, like, that's the book, that's the movie these folks want to see as well. So that's one. Second one is the commodification of legal stories in the form of the rise of Law and Order and NCIS and its tributaries. Law and Order starts in 1990. So by the time Law and Order's kick in 3 years later, there's a lot of shows with cops and lawyers, right? There's just a whole bunch of them. And then the third thing that I've got cooking here is Aaron Sorkin, which is A Few Good Men is around the same time. And there's lawyers there. And Sorkin writes lawyers, Trial of Chicago 7, virtually every character in the West Wing is a lawyer. And John Grisham cannot do what Aaron Sorkin does. And so I think that those properties peel off the liberal elite dummies like you and I from the law stories. And then the American Snipers peel off the red staters, right? The law and order, like the real law and order people that want to see institutions and laws and power upheld. So Grisham, he kind of occupies this weird middle space. He served in the Mississippi House of Representatives as a Democrat. Like, clearly his politics in the Pelican Brief are more closer to yours than mine, though they are an early 90s kind of politics, which we can talk about too. It has problems there. And so this kind of like democratic institutionalist worldview, I just don't think there's that much room for it, weirdly, in the popular situation. I think the other thing too is the idea of the conspiracy is something people care about, like something can use you election. Here's Donald Trump is probably going to be the Republican nominee if he wants to be. And his supporters stormed the White House. So this idea that you have to not run for your election because one of your supporters is a bad guy, which is the Pelican Brief thesis, is so irrelevant now, it'd be almost laughable, Amanda.
One of my top notes about it was like, after January 6th, this assassination of two Supreme Court justices just kind of doesn't seem like that far outside of the realm of possibility, and also doesn't seem like a thing maybe a third of the country would be sad about, depending on which who the justices were. So in my thinking of, like, would this book get written again today? No. And that's one of the reasons, is that, like, this is reality, actually. So we don't need it because we're in it.
Because I do remember the idea of assassinating two Supreme Court justices seemed shocking. Right. At the time, you know, even up until like the last 4 or 5 years, completely outside.
Until they tried to kill Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi in their chairs.
Until they said, let's hang the vice president. Right. And then it was like, well, and like, that's just, we're going to sweep that under
the rug. I guess that's where we are now.
So I think that political valence there is super fascinating as well. I mean, before we get to the Pelican Brief, I guess this is the backstory of Grisham a little bit that's interesting, I guess. And maybe one of the reasons people are tuning in is to get the context around these adaptations. Like, Time to Kill, 1989, his first book. Grisham, a lawyer himself, a political person himself who wanted to write books, wrote A Time to Kill, shopped it around, spent 4 years writing, got picked up. 5,000 print run, giant hit. The Firm and Pelican Brief follow hard upon. For a while there, he had the best-selling book in America for like 5 years running, to beat only by a little book called The Da Vinci Code. So an enormous, enormous book. I think I read the first six. I think I don't have the list in front of me, but up through The Runaway Jury or The Chamber. And those are all the ones that have movies of them, I think I've read the books of. And have forgotten them completely. It's been 25 years since I read them. And I guess, what is it? Why were these hits is hard to say. I postulated to you that he invented the legal thriller. After doing some research, I am a lying, ignorant idiot. That is not true at all. You go back to Wilkie Collins. Really, before Scott Turow with Presumed Innocent in 1987 initiates the modern legal thriller, I guess there's courtroom dramas and cop shows and noir, but what does Grisham bring to the table? And I think the idea of the conspiracy, right? But also the idea of the shady, soft power business, corporate, legal entities, and really exposing how much room there was for manipulation in a systemic way. I think that's new. Does that feel right to you?
I think it's the more realistic version of what Michael Crichton was doing at the same time in that way. Like, there's that big corporate shadiness, corporate espionage, corporate conspiracies.
Right.
The way that money ties into political campaigns was a big thing in the 90s that we don't talk about so much anymore, even though we should. After Citizens United. So yeah, I just made that connection to Crichton in my brain, but it does seem to be like of the moment, a topic of the moment.
And turning from the post Watergate sort of government conspiracy genre, and we should talk about this, Alan J. Pakula directed All the President's Men. He directed Parallax View. He was a producer on To Kill a Mockingbird. So this sort of intersection of the law and politics and the government is right up his alley. But I think coming out of the 80s, which the 80s did not have an appetite for seeing big business as the bad guy, and the turning to big business as the bad guy, I mean, in a way, it's almost a trope. Like, you need to find a villain in modern movies that's just not like a corporate entity, right? That's not like a Cayman Islands shell company. And that's still kind of a problem, is who the bad guys are. And it's, I think that's inheritance of something Grisham identified and exposed and then capitalized on by making them into thrillers where people are running through parking garages escaping car bombs
to be saved by Dobermans.
And he does have felicity with the ways that power work, right? You know, this appeals court and this amount of money and this statute and this law. It's very detailed, and you can find him almost having the most fun when he's talking about like the Byzantine nature of the shell corporations that Victor Matisse, the bad guy, has put in. Like, that feels like where he's having fun almost to me, is explaining all that stuff. But I think that was a real, that we were ready to hear about where the cracks in the system were differently and anew that we haven't heard about quite those way before. So I think that maybe, and then they're turn pages, baby. These are page turners, and that's always something that works.
I was shocked at how I had never read Grisham before. I've only seen, you know, the Floppity Jillion movies, but I was shocked at how I was like in it. I was engrossed. Yes. I was compelled. Like, he got me from the beginning.
Yep. And it's a really good point. I think that's, and it's unfair, unreasonable. You take that for granted for these people that can do this, you know, the Pattersons of the world, and that's their stock in trade, is getting people to turn pages. But in a lot of ways, that's what a lot of people look for sometimes, is turning the pages. And that's a marketable, clearly valuable skill. Now, is it that interesting from a non just trying to like pass time waiting at your gate to get to Newark? I don't know. But it works, man, and it makes money, and it certainly did. Now, on the other hand, once you pump out 7 or 8 of these, where do you go, right? I'm not sure how many else you can do. So I think that's another reason it faded away, is like you kind of saw the firm and the runaway jury and the chamber and the client and all that stuff. It's like, okay, I get it. The law's crappy and the governments are also bad and people are
so cynical.
And that's really baked in. From the pie. So let's talk about this. Mm. That was your big note, or that's the note that was text worthy to me, is how cynical the book is. Say more about that.
I mean, every character except for Darby and a little bit of Gray, who of course are the heroes, is awful. Is like a caricature of themselves. There's the professor having serial affairs with younger students. There's awful slimy Republicans. There's awful slimy lawyers. Just everybody is like the corporate. Nobody's nice. Not even the nice or not nice, but like nobody has good intentions.
Decent,
right.
Even.
Like nobody has good intentions, even if they're fumbling. Even the president, who is a Reagan-esque figure and is like not necessarily, he's not a criminal. He's like kind of a puppet. He's a little bit silly. He's kind of fumbling. He doesn't have overtly good intentions either. He's just there like to be a puppet for the bad people around him. And it just assumes the worst intentions of every single character except the two heroes. And, you know, that like very black and white, completely lacking in nuance sort of characterization is not a thing modern readers want anymore, I don't think. It's certainly not what I
don't think.
Want.
That's a great point.
It's just like very upsetting. I don't know. I didn't like it. And there's no hope. There's no, I mean, even at the end, which the good guys win, kind of. Sort of like that. You don't see Matisse coming to justice, but you know, the thing is exposed and the wheels are turning and the law is doing what it's supposed to do, which is go after the bad guys. You don't see them get their comeuppance, but you know that that's probably what's going to happen. That's how the book ends. Even though it ends on like kind of a hopeful note, there's no real hope. Like they still killed 2 Supreme Court justices and were allowed to do it. And it just feels very bleak.
It is very bleak. And the book is certainly bleaker than the movie. I mean, the president's a much worse person in the book, especially if you have a certain political persuasion. There is one moment where he's like, can't I just find a couple of white people to put on the court? Where are all the white, like, I just want white dudes.
Men.
Find me white dudes. It's like, and that felt super relevant. Mm-hmm. And like, I wonder how shocking that would have been to read as the business traveler in 1993, you know, kind of going to your earlier point. But all the people even that breathe some humanity, the actors especially, I think one of the pleasures of the movie is like, people are doing a lot with not that much and trying to make the stereotypes and tropes into something interesting. So John Hurt is Gavin Verheek. There's something about John Hurt that is just likable. Mm-hmm. You know, the dad in Home Alone who's sort of out to lunch, but somehow you don't blame him in Home Alone. Like, whatever he does also applies here. In the book, he's a philandering sort of gold digger, right? Who, you know, is real, a very unattractively amoral, if not sleazy person who just is thinking about Darby running around the beach in a string bikini, which is not what you want to read for me, that's what he wants. But in the movie gives him something to do, right? He cares about his friend Callahan who's died. He wants to help Darby. He's kind of a putz in terms of naive and what he's caught up in, thinks he can go handle it by himself. And then Vinton Doyles, who's the director of the FBI in the book, is very much like a careerist and just trying to survive. In the movie, you have some warmth for him because he's negotiating the terrain that he's getting.
Yeah.
Like, he seems like he wants to do the right thing. Callahan, Sam, I think the person who elevates the role the most is probably Sam Shepard as Callahan, because he plays him as sort of this tragic figure, but still very tough to handle. And then the Fletcher Cole as now a sort of stereotypical chief conniving careerist, do anything chief of staff. We've seen that trope a million times.
Have you seen Scandal, the greatest show ever made?
No, I know this dude is in it, right? What's his name?
Tony Goldwyn is the actor. He's the horrible chief of staff in the movie The Pelican Brief. He is also the slimy Republican president in every season of Scandal until his wife takes over. But like as soon as he got on the screen, you know, I haven't seen this movie since I watched Scandal, but I was like, oh, right, it's that guy. What is it about his face that makes him so castable as like an awful Republican? What is it?
I don't know, because he seems like the the guy at the frat that he's not the best looking or the athlete, but he's the smartest one. And so this is what he does, right? Like this is his, he's the short dude at the frat who gets good grades. And this is what happens. I like this story that Fletcher Cole, his character in Scandal is Fletcher Cole's ultimate goal is to sort of usurp the president and become the president himself. And then Robert Culp as the president plays him, as you say, buffoon is too strong, but not wrong. He's kind of an amiable, self-interested puff.
Yeah, he's
of
nothing.
A man.
He's just a nothing burger.
He's kind of nothing. You know, he's more interested in teaching his dog to roll over than doing really anything.
Mm-hmm. It reminded me of like the way that Bush Jr. was marketed, Bush the Younger. Like,
I think that's prescient. Yeah, that's a really
nice
good point.
And
that's a really good
I can
point.
Throw a football. I'm not super smart. And somehow
have
that's the draw.
With?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, have a beer with. Wasn't that the Bushism to some degree? So the book, I mean, I think that largely the plot is the same, I should say. In terms of the actual plot, it's largely the same. Darby in the book, I mean, I think we'll get this when we talk about how Julia Roberts was directed or chose to play this particular role. Darby is a stereotype, a trope of the leggy, good-looking, brilliant student who can do it all and also doesn't get that much to do.
I had a lot of problems with Darby in the book. A lot. Just,
yeah, speak on
she's it. I don't know anything about John Grisham as a person, but the way she's written, where she is just like sexually available to whatever older man is in the room and likes her, you know, like just feels like I'm reading John Grisham's weird private thoughts about like what he wants. You know, it just is gross. It's like a sexual Mary Sue. Like she has...
That's a great
very little agency.
That's a great short
hand. Yeah, she has very little agency. Which, I mean, maybe that's overstating because she's in this book trying to save her life and trying to, you know, like make justice happen and all of that. But when it comes to interacting with the older men around her, she's just there. Like she becomes this empty vessel for their thoughts about her legs. And I hated it, which I feel like for the book is surprisingly, in my opinion, progressive for the time and the genre that it's in about race. Like the way that he writes the janitor, I think is fascinating.
Fascinating.
And politics in general, like the whole thing is except for there are no women in it except for the 23-year-old that every old guy wants to bang. And I cannot deal with it.
And then the widow, right?
Oh,
widows
yeah,
and
the
receptionists.
Widow. Yep.
Those are the other women that get put in. I think that's a good point. It's both more and less progressive than you would be expect walking into the book at this point. Like the male gaze stuff is all over the place and completely self-conscious or aware
unexamined.
Or interested in interrogating. But the idea of like, you know, the Supreme Court and rights and give the Indians everything what you want. Now, the nomenclature is wrong, but a very progressive idea of like, Whatever the native folks are suing about, give them. That's what you know. Rosenberg's one of the lines there, and like, what is it? The government over business, the individual over government,
the environment over everything.
The environment over everything is Rosenberg's reason to deter. And I think you can kind of see some Grisham in there. But on the other hand, he's like, and if a leggy paralegal comes in, I'm going to hit on her. Like that's the other subtext or supertext here. Doesn't age very well. Gray Grantham. I hadn't read this book in 25 years. I didn't have any mental model of it except that I thought the plot was pretty much the same. There wasn't a big surprise. The big surprise to me is how there was no surprise. How Gray Grantham, the main male character here, is super uninteresting. Not much of her personality. I guess an okay reporter. It's not clear to me that he's a great reporter. You know, I guess figuring out Garcia and hiring a stooge to watch a phone booth for $15 an hour. I don't know that much about journalism, but it doesn't seem particularly brilliant to me. So that everything that Denzel does is Denzel magic with Gray when it turns into that particular way. I guess the biggest plot change, which we're really going to need to talk about when we talk about the adaptation of the movie, is Darby and Gray have a sexual relationship in the book, you know, a romantic relationship. And in the movie, they don't.
Thank God.
thank God. And also, it's more interesting that way. And also, I don't know if you did how much research you did about... Apparently, this was Denzel's decision.
Oh, I did not know. I did not know that.
Imprint on the screenplay, which we can get into. But I think that adds a layer of sophistication that Grisham doesn't deserve or it doesn't warrant, right? This idea that they have a professional relationship rather than, you know, everyone is passing on her brief because of her legs rather than she's actually got something here. Which is the truth, because she does figure it out. I mean, not for nothing, she figures it out and is kind of learning as she goes in the book, especially like how to avoid the CIA. Good job, except she's not avoiding CIA because they're watching her all the time. Anyway, it's a little confusing, but she does a good job. And even still, that's de-emphasized somehow. It's like she's a brilliant young woman who's very capable and resourceful, and everyone's thinking about bikinis, man.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm not sure. What else about the book? Those are my big highlights, I guess, to take away.
I think that was about it. The janitor, I do think I want to like hang a lantern on the...
You want to talk about that now or as the adaptation? Your choice.
Oh, well, it's different in the adaptation. Like, he doesn't get as much airtime.
Yes.
In the book, the janitor...
Okay, let's talk about... Yeah, I think that's interesting because his son also isn't in the movie, right? His son is the go-between between Gray and Sarge, which is the janitor. Yeah, what do you want to say?
So Sarge is the janitor in the White House who cleans the West Wing and kind of pretends to be blind a little bit so that he can have access to like conversations and listen and then pass on information to Grantham, the reporter, through his son Cleve, who is a black cop in DC, which I also think was very interesting. But Sarge is very aware of how he's perceived by all the powerful white men around him, and he uses it to entertain himself. And I think that the fact that that's like really not emphasized in the movie is such a shame, because it was so, again, like weirdly progressive coming from John Grisham, who is just this like white lawyer politician guy from the South. From the South is like especially interesting, I guess. But I loved it. I would read an entire book about Sarge's life. Like, please write that.
Oh, that's a great ongoing bit for us to do. It's like, okay, if you could have a extended the John Grisham EU, where do you want a miniseries about? I think Sergeant Cleve is fascinating.
Like, he has no respect for the people he's spying on, essentially. He seems to have a lot of respect for the institutions he's trying to preserve, but he's mostly there for the lulls. Like, he's passing on this information. He's not getting paid.
Yeah,
right. He's like a Loki. No. Like, he's not getting paid. He has no financial investment. He just, it's hilarious that he takes advantage of these idiots' bias around him for his own, like, funniness. I just love that.
Yeah, he's trolling them, like using Du Boisian double consciousness, right? Which is amazing to see at work. And I do think we haven't talked about this, the idea of like the Grishamian, the Grishamic. I don't know how to make it into a adjective. Milieu is like the Mid-South, like New Orleans up through Memphis, Louisville over to D.C., you know, with a little stops everywhere around. And so as a white elite Democrat.
In the 90s.
This idea of like. In the 90s, he is straddling the racial line in ways that other people aren't in pop culture. And I think I'm sure this is written by a black person is completely different. But Grisham does have these moments of like he talks about race. Mm-hmm. He includes people of color. He gives them things to do, though they're not the stars. But he does have some sense of how these things can work in a more sophisticated way, which is pretty interesting. I don't have anything. It sold a billion copies. I don't think there's much else to say about the book. Let's do another break and we'll get into the movie proper. I guess there's two big changes. I already said I've said them both, but they are the backpedaling removal of an explicit or really even implicit romantic relationship or desire between Darby and Gray in the movie. And then of course, race bending Gray into the black character. Michelle and I were having a long, conversation this morning about how Denzel being Gray matters and doesn't matter. In terms of the actual plot of the movie, it doesn't matter.
No, there's right? one line doesn't, that it, Lithgow drops about how if I take you off this case, you're going to sue me for discrimination. And that's really the only time it's acknowledged.
On the other hand, it's not a race blind. The movie does take into account that Denzel is black, I think is an interesting way. That line is one. Mm-hmm. Another one is that, and these are small, and I think it's 93. It's important to remember that the time is what the time was, that he's wearing a Howard t-shirt at one point. He didn't go to Harvard. He's not one of these, you know, as a black reporter, he is not a Harvard lobbyist, think tanker, right? He's on the outside in that regard. And I think importantly, his relationship to Sarge is made more interesting because he's black, right? In the book, we get an explanation that Sarge, why is he feeding him the stuff, like you say, for the lulls? In the movie, we don't get that, but we almost don't need it because you see them together buying coffee and Sarge is doing it to help a brother out, it looks like. Like, he's a reporter, he's a black reporter, and he wants to give him some stuff, and he trusts him, and he wants to do well by the country and Gray and the truth. So it seems, even those small scenes, much more altruistic. Mm-hmm. And then another scene when Gray and Darby are at Georgetown Law School trying to get class records and track down interns so they can ID Garcia. Mm-hmm. The student that overhears Gray and tells him where Edward Linney is black. Mm. And in that moment, there's a moment where it feels like the student is doing it because he wants to help Gray mm-hmm. out. Because you know he's a law student at Georgetown.
Yeah.
He knows who Gray Grantham is. He just does know who that is. Mm-hmm. And so he's interested in making a connection and helping him out. There's a similar scene sort of in Philadelphia, which is an interesting analog to this. Talk about My Two Dads and the parting of the ways between Denzel and Tom Hanks, where Denzel is in a bodega and a law student comes up and says, everything you're doing is so fascinating and thank you so much for helping the cause. And Denzel's character at that moment thinks it's because he's black, but it's because he's gay. And Denzel, the character is a very complicated, let's say, charitably relaxed. But anyway, these little social things matter in the movie. And I think it's just a fascinating, fascinating role for Denzel to take. He's my favorite thing in it. And I don't think if this is anybody else, I ever watched this movie twice. That's my sort of takeaway after watching it again. Anything else about Denzel? Amanda, you
there was another scene that I'm remembering now where he's trying to tail someone. I don't remember who he's chasing.
Oh,
and he tries to get in the taxi, but he's a black man wearing a hoodie and the taxi won't let him
in the car. Right. Won't let him in the car.
I don't think, after the last couple of years and like specific conversations about hoodies and black men in public, I don't know that I would have caught that as like a notable moment. Like,
I don't think so either. And I wonder, is that Alan or is that Denzel? I wonder if Denzel's like, you know what actually would happen right there?
He wouldn't get in the cab. Like, the cab would drive off. Yeah.
The cab would drive off. That's a fact. But it kind of goes in the same category of all these little, they don't actually affect the outcome that much, but they are a recognition that it matters that he's black. Mm-hmm. It actually does have some import. Denzel is not quite at the peak of his powers. He's coming off Malcolm X, which launches him into superstardom. He has several interesting kind of roles, but you're right. This in Philadelphia brings him sort of the end of his, might he be the Tom Hanks, Paul Newman kind of a character, and more towards him to the, he's got a little more Bruce Willis in him than Tom
that's
Hanks.
That's true.
Towards the end of his, the latter career. Let's talk about Julia Roberts.
Oh, man. I have a lot. Just hard to articulate. She's given nothing, right? Like, Darby is nothing.
Let me position her career, then I'm going to throw it over to you. Because where she is in this particular moment, I think, is interesting. She's coming off, after Pretty Woman, she is the biggest female star in the world. Or the female movie star in the world. I think what's weird to me about Julia Roberts is she's been in a lot fewer big hit movies than you think.
Yeah.
And really, between this and 1999's Notting Hill, it's a kind of a tough run for Julia Roberts. Interesting, a return to form is in a movie that's not unrelated to this, which is Erin Brockovich, in which she also plays a sort of paralegal person who's fighting big business that one is more overtly using sexual powers, and I think in a way that's more empowering than male gazey, but it's still kind of fruits of the same tree. I think this movie doesn't know what to do with Darby, and I don't think Julia Roberts does, and I find her winning always on screen, but she's neither the Shrinking Violet nor the, I'm trying to think of an analog in 93 that she could have been, but a little more like feisty, I guess, is maybe what I was looking for from Darby Shaw and Julia Roberts, who I think she has Julia Roberts seems to do two things particularly well, maybe better than anyone I've ever seen on screen. One is to play herself or a version of herself in Ocean's 11 or Notting Hill, which she's very self-aware about, like the 1,000-watt smile and the Julia Roberts baggage. And the other one is sort of the a girl next door approachability in Mystic Pizza or Runaway Bride or Steel Magnolias, right? Where she is the center of the room she's in, but she's not Julia Roberts or playing a shadow of Julia Roberts to some degree. And this isn't either of those things. And I'm not sure what kind of direct, like, did Alan just say, hey, so when in doubt, whisper, Julia.
When in doubt,
in this movie, just whisper. So I'm going to throw, that's why I'm positioning her here. She's coming after this movie, it's a dry spell. And then she comes back. And I think it threw her off this kind of big budget. She didn't do an action movie. She doesn't do an Angelina Jolie turn or anything like that. She's never really done Tomb Raider, Lara Croft, Salt, one of those. And I wonder it's because she looked at this like, boy, that was a tough hang for me.
The whispering thing, I spent so much time after I watched this movie this weekend being like, why is everyone talking so quietly? Like, nobody yes. yells. Nobody yells until the lawyer, the white and whatever, the bad guy.
Balsamo. Yeah, Balsamo.
Until he yells and calls first. Grantham a son of a bitch. Nobody yells. Like, everybody is just very chill. And it's because...
She screams and she cries, yeah. but that's only when a car bomb
goes like, there's
off.
No... Nobody speaks really quickly. No, and I couldn't figure out if it was Denzel doing it or if it was Julia Roberts doing it. Because especially when they're together, they... And I think it's Julia because, like you said, she doesn't know what to do with her hand eyes. So she's just like speaking in a very... I think she's trying to pull off traumatized. And so all she has is monotone. Mm-hmm. And then Gray is afraid of spooking her. And so he just matches her tone. And yes. so anytime
that's a great
they're
example.
Together...
That's a great observation.
Yeah, anytime they're together, it's just this very quiet kind of way of talking. And it's so noticeable and distracting and strange, especially from her, because she has such a big... She's got a big face, you know, big personality, big gestures, yeah. like big actress. But here she's so no affect, like level, except in the moments after the explosion. From then on, it's just one note. And Gray really meets her there. But I just, it's so confusing. I think she did the best with what she had. And if you had to typecast a leggy redhead, there you go. Like, there's your, in a box, Julia Roberts, Merry Christmas.
I don't think she's bad. And I think Michelle said, she's not a good part, or it's the part as written is not that interesting. It could be a lot more interesting because clearly we can talk about Callahan and some other things in a minute, but I think the movie itself admits that her natural charisma is a bit of a problem because the last shot of the film is it's Julia Roberts smiling quietly to herself
on a
about
beach.
Something Gray says.
Yeah.
And you've got to be careful with Julia Roberts' smile. It takes you, it's a completely different movie when she flashes those things.
Yeah.
Like, it's a weapon. Like, if she smiles in the middle of the Marriott scene, we're like, it's not serious anymore. Yeah. It's like, it's Julia Roberts. Everything's going to be fine. So it's like, there's some part of it that she has to kind of like rein in her charisma, mm-hmm. likability, everything's fine. Plot armor for black, you know, to use a trope. So it's very tough. And I think if she was, of course she's going to be traumatized. That's fine. But if she was more embattled than traumatized, mm-hmm. if she was more resolved than rattled, every time there's this one scene where she's and it's one of our favorite scenes is when she's narrated, you're listening to Gray listen to the tape
yes.
of her telling him this story, and she's whispering there, and I kind of like that scene for a lot of metatextual reasons, but that's an interesting filmic moment, but she sounds like she's coming out of a coma. Like, I just don't, there's now, if she was more resolved, I think it would play better. And I think some of the moments she gets later are actually fairly good because she is clearly resourceful. You believe Julia Roberts is being smart and tricky in this movie, which I don't know that you necessarily do before this movie. Think of her as a thinker, right? When you see the roles that she generally gets. But I believed her as figuring this stuff out and a quick on her feet liar, you know, conniving sort of person in her own right. But they just can't get away from that she's a scared bird.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's a good use of Julia Roberts. I don't think it's a good use of a female character like this at all. But I don't think it's a good use of Julia Roberts because this movie, to me, the heart of it is, I mean, this is weird to say, it gets going about an hour and a half in when Julia and Denzel are together figuring crap out. That's the best part of this movie.
Yeah.
And it just takes too long to get there. And it could have been even better in watching it now if she had a little more repartee sparriness with Denzel. And I don't want the romance stuff.
No,
I don't want that.
No.
But I do want her to be like, I've survived without you, man. And I want to figure this out and avenge my dude and get these bastards. Because the other thing that she's motivated mostly by surviving, which is totally reasonable, but usually we want from a hero is they're doing something for a good reason. And it takes her a long time to get to, I want to figure this out and not save my skin.
Yeah. And I don't think her age, I understand why she's the age, you know, she's a law school student. She's in her early 20s, right. Fine. She's 24 or 23. But I cannot imagine a 23 or 24 year old who doesn't have like military experience, not immediately taking, anyone up on their offers for government protection. Right. How many FBI agents call her and are like, could you please just come in? Like, we will protect you. And she just refuses. And it's so unbelievable to me. I could not get over it. And when she tries to do like steely, like, no, I'm going to do it on my, it's just so unbelievable. Come on. You're 23. You don't know what you're doing.
One of the things that's, I mean, of its time and place, one of the things that struck me is like when she wants to disappear, I guess this is more in the book. You don't really get this in the movie, but when she wants to like lose a tail, she goes to the airport and gets on a plane. Yeah. And that's such a pre-Patriot move. Yeah. Because right now, you go to the airport, the TSA knows where you are, and that immediately, like, the government would know immediately where you are. But this idea that you could escape by going onto a plane, and all you have to do is not use your credit card, I found fascinating as a, what a different world it was in 93, just moving around the country unmarked, unnoticed, for better or worse and whatever. But that was definitely a piece of it as well. My least favorite part of the movie is the Callahan trope. The professor sleeping with the student. Those of you listening to me on other shows know that's maybe my single least favorite trope for all kinds of reasons. I think it doesn't do anyone a disservice here. Michelle and I were talking about this before. So one of the things the story, both in book and film, have to figure out is how does this no-name law student's brief end up on Venton Doyle's desk, right? How does this happen? And basically, you need to get to Verheek, right? That's one of the lawyers that has, you know, the ear of the FBI director. And the way that they do it is say that one of his old friends, who happens to be in the book, especially seems a very mediocre teacher at Tulane or, you know, whatever, you know, they meet for a drink because their shared buddy Rosenberg is dead. And Sam passes, or Callahan passes along to Verheek because he's sleeping with this girl. And you want to see how her mind works. Isn't this weird? Aha, pretty little girl with this interesting idea. It's just terrible.
Yeah.
It's such a bad taste in your mouth. And I said, again, I think I understand why you need to do this. You need to get someone who's outside to have a different way of thinking and then figure out a way for it to plausibly get to director's desk. I think you solve this problem pretty easily. You make Sam Shepard a woman, and this is a mentor-mentee relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Julie Roberts is the star pupil of some hotshot lawyer who has a friend in the FBI and says, you know, Gavin, I know you get a lot of things, but I read this thing by this student, and I can't shake it. Mm-hmm. I need to pass it on. You're done with all that stuff. And then she blows up in a car bomb, and like it's the same thing, but you don't have this sort of specter of sleaze that is so unnecessary. And I like Sam Shepard, and I think he does as much as you could by making him sort of like this broken man who is, you know, doesn't seem to be preying on students like he kind of does seem to be in the book. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't matter, but that's the one I was like, if I had to make a screenwriting change, I think that's my single biggest change. I mean, do you have anything along those lines?
Well, the whole kind of premise is not great. Like the idea that law enforcement would not immediately start looking at cases that were on their way to the Supreme Court for suspects.
Yeah.
Like that whole idea is laughable. Of course they would immediately start looking at cases.
They try to deal with that in the book by saying there are so many, but I have no sense if that's a believable excuse.
I'm sure there are.
I don't know.
If you've killed two Supreme Court justices, the whole arm of like every law enforcement arm that could possibly be involved would be. And like, where else would you start looking? It's just so goofy. Like, the whole premise is goofy.
That is fairly goofy. That is fairly goofy.
I think that... So, my favorite part of the movie is none of the people. It's the fact that you don't get the brief until almost the end. Like, you don't actually get... And it's different in the book. In the book, you kind of know what's going on, or, like, what her theory is earlier. But in the movie, she doesn't read it until she mumblecores the whole thing. Like, with 45 minutes left, you still have no idea what the motive is or who the actual bad guy is until you're almost done. And I think that's fascinating and completely compelling. Like, I knew who the bad guy is because I'd read the book, but I was still here for it. Like, I'm still along for this ride. How are they going to reveal this bad guy? And it makes the president and his chief of staff seem way more ominous than they are, because you don't know what their connection is until the end.
Yeah,
you just know there is one.
That's a really good point. What's the question of the movie? It's really not so much who did it, but how much the White House is implicated.
Yeah.
Right? That's kind of, and whether or not, you know, Darby's going to get blown up, he's going to figure it out. But I think we know, just because of the kinds of movie and stars we're dealing with, that's going to happen. But like, is Fletcher Cole at one point turns to president and says, you know, Victor told us.
Yeah.
you know, Victor said that. But like, I had a similar thing, but it was less about the brief itself than about Batiste, who we don't never see.
Yeah, you never see the
sentence
villain.
From. No. He's like, there's one photo, I think, that's talked about. But you know what? It doesn't matter. Because we all know the bad guy. The specific doesn't matter, because the real bad guy is the influence of money in politics and justice, right? That's the bad guy. And you could give it it's the villain with 1,000 faces, to paraphrase Joseph Campbell to some degree. And even the contents of the brief itself also don't really matter to some degree.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons it doesn't come. It's like, if it's true, we all kind of have a sense of like, it's sleazy corporate stuff. You know, it just is. And it's like not that interesting. So don't bother wasting any time on it. Can I tell you a weird sort of like contingent part of one of the things about my viewing experience of this movie has been over the years? So after when we went into the DVD universe, out of the cable universe, especially when Michelle and I were, you know, kind of broke in New York and we didn't have cable, we had a huge DVD collection. We asked them for gifts. We gave them each other to build up our repertoire. And one of the ones we had was a Pelican Brief, of course. But because the movie was so long, and I guess, I don't know, Warner Brothers or whatever cheaped out on the technology, it was two discs.
Oh.
So you had to flip it. You had to switch discs in the middle. And the moment you had to flip the disc is when Gray starts listening to her.
Oh, no.
Narrate, which is right in the middle of my favorite part. So I would usually put in the second disc. So I hadn't seen the beginning of this movie in a billion years, but I think it does. It's just one of those weird. And then, so we bought it later. It's like, okay, finally, we have enough money. I'm going to buy the Blu-ray. Well, there's no Blu-rays. Okay. I'll buy a new DVD because surely, no, buy a Blu-ray also on two discs. And there we go. So I bought this on Apple. I got to watch as one unseen thing. But like that middle, that I think that withholding both of Denzel and Darby's relationship, the Brief and Matisse, makes it somewhat interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't get it all from the beginning, because we get in the movie Gray behind Rosenberg in the first shot, because apparently he's just done an interview with Rosenberg, which is a complete creation for the movie. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you don't get Gray till well end. You don't get Denzel. You wouldn't have Denzel on screen for much later. I think the mumblecore stuff is Pakula said that worked in All the President's Men, and I'm just going to do this. Because my theory of the case here is this is the Fugitive meets All the President's Men. That's what the Pelican Brief really is. You get woman on the run, woman and man on the run with the government lawyer investigative stuff. And I'm a stooge for newspaper movies.
Yeah.
I love them all. I love anything where you have a reporter doing reporter tradecraft to get answers. I eat it all up. I've said before, if I had to do it all over again or live a parallel life, I'd like to be a reporter of some kind and do all this kind of stuff, even though I don't have the gumption or my Midwestern temerity wouldn't allow me to sort of cold call people and lie to them. But I do like this. But to me, it's Denzel and Julia, especially after it's revealed that they go try to figure out who Garcia is and they get everything else. That's my favorite part of the movie. I think they have really good chemistry. Darby gets to do a little bit more. Denzel, you don't get this very often, and you get it more now, but a black guy figuring things out was not something you saw.
Yeah.
And he's really, he reads as smart. He reads as street smart and book smart. And I just love Denzel's. Somehow Denzel's mumbling makes more sense to me. I think you hit the nail on the head, which is he's tone matching, and he's not trying to sell. He's not trying to scare Garcia. He's not trying to scare Darby. He's not trying to scare any of the students. Like he's just trying to like get along. But I really enjoyed him watching him think, watching him work, especially with Julia on the screen. So that's what I'd say there too. Other favorite bits from the movie, Amanda, or any other?
What
else sticks out to you as we're talking about?
John Lithgow. John Lithgow.
What a breath of fresh air he was, right? Talk
and
about
he's
that.
Such a perfect, like, he is an archetypal cranky newspaper editor.
Yes.
Like, just nails it. Nails it. And he's just so, like, tired and annoyed. And
it's just supposition.
Yes, just wants to move on. And he eats crow in the end when Denzel turns out to be right. Well, he eats crow really when Denzel's car gets blown up and he's like afraid that he's killed him.
Bird girl, she's
But he's just perfect. He's so, so good. And just exactly what I imagine all newspaper editors to be. And I know that's wildly
suspenders,
incorrect. Yeah.
Balding, gray, shock of weird gray haircut.
He never mentions circulation numbers. He never mentions newspaper sales. He's like only in it for the story and just perfect. Yes, loved it. I need to talk about Stanley Tucci as the assassin.
I didn't know how we were going to handle this. I'm not sure what to say about this.
I had no recollection. I've seen this movie so many times. I had no recollection that this was Stanley Tucci. And he got on the screen on Sunday afternoon when I watched it. And I came off the... I left my body. I came off the sofa! Stanley Tucci? No. Absolutely not.
America's concierge.
Right.
America's maitre d'. Murder and supreme.
He makes pasta and drinks wine and like wears suits nicely. Yeah. And that is what Stanley Tucci does. And the like brown washing him as an Egyptian terrorist is a no for me. I could not.
That's very 90s. That's very Lou Diamond Phillips is every person of color you need in the 90s move.
I could not handle it. True. I could not handle it. He's not scary. I mean, maybe he was scary when I watched it when I was a teenager, but now I'm like, is this Miranda would not approve from The Devil Wears Prada. This is not going to work for me. I couldn't. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's the Kamel character in the book is also a tough hang on the whole. I'm not sure what we know and don't know about multi-million dollar international assassins.
Not much.
I think the Tucci thing is super weird in hindsight. At the time, you didn't know. He was no one at this time. I mean, I don't think he's in Devil Wears Prada 13 years later. Yeah. His big role before that, I mean, I don't even know what you pick him out of. Frankly, so that is a strange one. I will say that the unnerving Kamel moment for me is when he does John Hurd's voice.
Oh, yeah.
Right, he listens to the tape and he immediately, and I don't know if that's Tucci, he like why he got cast at this. I think he looks vaguely Mediterranean. Yeah. I guess is what they were going for. There is a blankness to him that's disturbing, I think, but that's dime a dozen. Mm-hmm. Now disturbing competent assassin who just wants money. That's a wake up if you haven't seen it. It's a really good cast. I think mm-hmm. everyone's in it. It's really including the sleazeballs. It's a good cast all up and down. Grisham really has fun. He makes hay with names. We get Darby Shaw, mm-hmm. Gray Grantham, Venton Doyle, Fletcher Cole, mm-hmm. Victor Matisse. Like he revels in names, which I'm not sure what that's about, but he has a really good time with. I guess other star sightings. Baby Cynthia Nixon as best friend Alice.
Yes. Another moment where I was like, whoa, I forgot you existed in this movie.
And also the early 90s were a long time ago.
She has since run for governor, and that's weird.
Yeah, right. And come all the way back around to starring in, looks like, misbegotten Sex in the City reboots or whatever we're doing at this point now. Let's talk about the romantic stuff between Gray and Julia. So it doesn't sound like this surfaced to you. I didn't remember this. Michelle remembered it, so I went and looked it up proactively. It's not really clear now exactly, because it's Julia Roberts talking later about, it sounds like the decision or whatever, that Denzel insisted that they not have a kiss, right? That they not have a romantic relationship. Before we get into this, at the end, I guess, were you surprised in the book to see that Gray and Darby had a romance? Like, they were knocking boots or about to or whatever?
Yeah, I was surprised. Where he comes on to her and she says, I'm not ready. And it's been literally 10 days since the love of her life was murdered in front of her. And I just could not. No, I was surprised.
Yeah, very bad stuff. In the movie, I've always kind of wondered about, like, what their relation was. Is there a subtext here? Is this a fried green tomatoes situation where they're actually, and I think on the whole I've come to, especially after reading some of the other stuff, like they've been through it together. Yeah. They have affection for each other and that's great, you know. I mean, that's wonderful. I think it's cool that it does subvert the expectation. If this is Tom Cruise, I guess, well, that's a different kettle of fish in a variety of different ways. But if this is not Denzel, who apparently nixed a kiss for reasons of not wanting to alienate his core fan base, which is black women. Apparently he was in a movie called The Mighty Quinn and he kissed a white woman and he was in the audience and the black woman in the audience booed. And he's like, oh, that's fascinating.
Oh.
And he went for another 15 years before there was some movie in 2013. I don't have the notes in front of me. And he went through this whole, you know, went through a whole string of movies where he did not have romantic relationships on screen with women who weren't black. He also, at another point, someone said that maybe he thought that white people didn't want to see an interracial kiss.
That's what I assumed. He didn't think,
at one point, there was something said he just didn't think it was right for the movie. So maybe more along the lines of the wavelength I'm on. Like, I didn't think about the racial dynamics much at all, other than I kind of just liked that, you know, she didn't have to move from one dude's bed to another to get through this shit. I think it works. I think it's great, even if I'm sad that there's a racial element that people have to negotiate for a variety of different reasons. But I think on its own merits, whether or not he's black or not, I prefer it if they're just kind of in the foxhole together and they've got a comrades in arms relationship by the end of wanting to protect each other. And, you know, that makes a lot of sense to me. I'm not sure if there's anything interesting in there for you, Amanda, but I did think that was, it sounds like it was a, political choice more than a storytelling mm-hmm. choice, but I think the storytelling choice ultimately was the right one anyway.
Yeah, I agree. And I did not know that about Denzel not wanting to kiss white women, but I totally get it. Mm-hmm. I had assumed the other way around, that the movie, like the when it was over, I was like, oh, they just didn't want to deal with the backlash of having Julia Roberts kiss a black man. Like, I that probably would have been a mm-hmm. whole thing. And I'm glad to be wrong about that, I guess. But I agree that it is better. It's a better story if they don't, like, not everything has to be speed, you know, where the way we process this trauma is by dating. No, that's not necessary. No. She is also, not for nothing, like 15 years younger than him in the movie and book. And stop it. I just can't.
I think the movie also, I mean, since it's Julia Roberts, you don't have to play up that she's good looking, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have her wear these dresses and stuff that the book does. Like, she did. Also, it's early 90s fashion, which is maximalist, right? Like, Denzel is a very handsome man, but he's wearing this gray suit that looks nine sizes too big for him in today's fashion. And she's wearing, like, the Meg Ryan, like, I don't know what the name for these things are, but basically shoulder to ankle maxi. I don't even know what these things are that no one wears anymore that Meg Ryan wore.
They're like prairie dresses. 90s. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not seeing a lot of Julia Roberts, right? There's not a lot. And that's fine. But it is interesting that for as much as there is sexualization of Darby in the book, she's undercover literally and figuratively throughout the movie. Let's see. I guess the idea of, I'm not sure how you came down on this, is how both dated and relevant the Supreme Court stuff.
Oh, God, yeah.
On the whole. Like, they're protesting about abortion and gun rights on the steps of the Supreme Court building. Rosenberg is actively thinking about trying to live long enough to live to see a Democratic president so he can be put on the bench. Mm-hmm. That the president and Fletcher Cole thinking about reshaping the court is going to be their legacy. The structural stuff about the Supreme Court was a problem 30 years ago, still a problem. I don't know if there's anything news at 11, I guess, Amanda. What about the politics of the day? Did anything strike you especially?
It struck me mostly as not having changed much. Like, the introduction is it Rosenberg or whoever he's talking to, which I think it was his clerk, about how everything is so divisive and this president ran such a divisive campaign and everybody out there is like, it's shocking how dangerous it is to be politically active these days. And I was like, wow, I guess nothing has changed.
Does that make you feel better or worse? I'm not sure.
Both?
On the one part, there's nothing new under the sun. On the other hand, we're all getting radiation poisoning, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me feel kind of better in as much as, like, the long arc of the universe is towards justice. I'm like, maybe things haven't changed, but a lot of things have changed. Like, maybe the fact that we're this divided and partisan and up each other's, down each other's throats. I don't know. I can't get my directions right. Is not super new. And I know that, you know, being a history nerd, there have been periods in American history where we've been much more divided than we are now. Like, literally killing each other in the streets in large, organized ways, which we are not doing now. And I don't think we will ever do again. So it made me feel better in that way, but it was also like, wow, we just cannot get it together. Like, Christian was writing about this almost 30 years ago, and we just cannot get it together.
I know.
I thought, I had a moment when I was reading it of like, why didn't he just make Rosenberg a woman? Because obviously this is an RBG stand-in, but she wasn't benched until 93. So, which in my brain, she just existed on the Supreme Court forever. But so much of the narrative around her when she died was, why didn't she retire when we had a Democrat in office? And so it felt like it was the same thing. Like, he was saying the same thing about Rosenberg, but my timing was all wrong because she was immortal until she wasn't.
Right. Well, and Rosenberg, I mean, I guess we don't know enough of, like, what the faux past history, like, how long has Rosenberg been old enough to retire?
Yeah.
Right? Should he have retired with the last president, I guess, is sort of the similar question. Like, in this one, he's explicitly waiting, but we don't know. So, Robert Culp, the president doesn't have a name, interestingly, in the book or the movie. It's just the president. But Robert Culp, who plays the president, he's thinking about running for re-election, so it has to be his first term. Mm-hmm. So he can't have been in office for that long. Maybe we're supposed to think the prior president was also Republican, especially if we're thinking about this book is written in 92. We're coming out of Reagan, Bush. Mm-hmm. So it's been 12 years. So it could have been that Rosenberg was 79, if we sort of think of this as diverging from our own history, and rather than Clinton winning, it was another Republican winning. It could have been a long time since there was a Democrat, in that Rosenberg has been waiting a long time. Now, maybe you should retire when you're 78. That's still I don't know. Briar, are you listening? Please.
Your mouth's to God's ear.
Yeah. And I think that's fascinating. You know, the another one that I think we could do away with is Jensen sort of being closeted and being, we haven't talked about it because I think it's so obvious that that is not something that would exist now.
Also, that scene in the movie, I fast forward through the assassination of Jensen because it's such a long, awkward amount of time to spend listening to porn.
Michelle said the exact same thing. We have to watch Stanley Tucci maybe going to unbutton his pants. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, he's like, I can't say any of these words to Manda or anybody else about what actually was going on there. You know that I'm a prude by nature. And it's too much. It's too much. And the movie is very long. It's 2.5 hours. And I think as much as that you can't, what I would want, I'm not a movie maker. I don't know what I'm talking about. So all caveats aside. But in terms of what I want more Julia and Denzel figuring stuff out together. I just want more of it. Move it earlier. Give them more to do. Maybe some of the stuff that happens on their own they can do later. I don't know. But that's what I come for. I don't come for the machinations of Kamel and Fletcher Cole and Culp sort of saying, I'm not sure. That's not what I'm looking for, which is good for me because I start on disc two. And that's most of where that happens. If I get another 15 minutes of disc one, I would have been a happy camper. Looking through my notes. Now we're into the bits and bobs kinds of pieces. I think the best line in the movie to me is given to a character we don't know the name of. My favorite line when Gray is at the rehab clinic and says, the law school told me I could come over and get it from you. And she's like, well, the funny thing is they run their law school and we run our clinic to Gray. Big energy from Debbie at the counter. Loved her. Any other moments or lines that stick out to you, Amanda, as personal favorites?
Most of the Sarge stuff I love just because I love that character. Yeah. I don't know that actor.
I worry about you,
Sarge. I know. Same. I also Denzel in his cabin was like a out of left field kind of thing.
That's
like,
right.
He doesn't have a cabin in the book. And why does he have to go? I know he can't go back to his apartment because he knows that it's bugged, but like he could go to a hotel. Why does he have a cabin? Because somehow we have to get Darby to him without anyone seeing because she's supposed to be out of the country. So she treks through the woods with a flashlight making all the dogs bark. Like, it's just completely
it's a good point. I had a thought about that. Let me try this on for a second. I think that scene exists to give Darby some more shine of like being clever because she's faking out Gray and everybody else, right? I wanted to think I would left the country and that includes you. But also then to find him, she has that moment of like, I called the paper and told him I was your sister and you're not the only one to do research and kind of gives a wry smile where they're more intellectual tradecraft equals. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, he's like, oh, I'm dealing with, I don't have to have her under my wing. Like we can be partners in this and they sort of proceed as there, but it is a little bit strange. Also, I think, and I don't know, maybe I'm reading too much and I don't know, in terms of the very subtle racial acknowledgement of Denzel's in the woods by himself and you hear dogs in the background. And I think that he's subject to just white violence at all times. Mm-hmm. There was that echo to me there. And I don't know how much of that was intentional, but it's hard not to have a black man standing alone in the woods with dogs and not have like slave fugitive justice
so
kind of overtone stuff going on. Yeah.
I really love,
so I think it does a couple of things.
Oh, sorry. I was just moving left field.
Let's move it.
I loved this scene at the end when Darby and Voiles, the FBI director, are talking and he's like, you know, so what are you going to do next? Like he just is accepting that this woman has brought down an entire government and he's just here for it. He doesn't like the president. He's not on board for covering a thing up if he doesn't have to. Like, he's such a fast. I think that the Voiles character, the FBI director, is really interesting, especially coming off of our own FBI director woes of the past 5 years. And like Comey and all that. And so
he's like chaotic neutral.
He is chaotic neutral.
Good chaotic. Like, yes. I'm not sure. I'm not as good as these as some people.
I think he's lawful neutral, which I am also lawful neutral. So it appeals to me. Mm. It appeals to me. This like, I will do what I think is right as long as I don't have awful consequences, in which case I will do whatever, you know, and because whatever. But he's just acceptance that this 23-year-old has outwitted him and everyone around him is great. He doesn't give her like, did you have help? He doesn't give her flack. He doesn't grill her. He just accepts that she's kind of brilliant and offers to get her out of the country and lets it go. And I thought that was great.
that actor also brings something really, a warmth and likability also, but also a sense of, I like this guy, but I'm not sure about him. James Sicking, who's one of those people, this is probably his biggest role, but you see him in a million things and I always kind of feel the same way around. A character actor, I think passed away a few years ago.
I imagined him.
Nope, still alive. Never mind. He's still alive. Sorry, James.
I imagined him as, this is so goofy, as Barr, like William Barr in my head.
William Barr.
Because he, in the book, is described as essentially Santa Claus, like physically.
Yeah, stumpy kind of.
But like, and like is in the Oval Office, but really secretly hates the president. And also, but is, you know, the guy in charge of running this branch for a Republican and is, doesn't seem particularly liberal at all. But in that way that Barr, like, turned out to really hate the entirety of his life under the Trump administration. So when I was,
he's deep stating it, baby. Yeah, so, Doyle's a deep stater. He's a deep
when
stater.
I was reading it, I was like, oh, this dude is Barr, which is kind of funny.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, he's pretty good. Let's see. The whole Morgan Garcia, I continue to find that very compelling. With the scene of him, that video that they pull out of, kind of a great little sequence, honestly. The videotape as a character, we got frontline videotapes, we get videotapes like
damn PBS.
We're very, very the VHS of PBS, big frontline energy, which is not in the book. Mm-hmm. Also, that actually clarifies a little bit about how Darby finds out. Like, what is it that she knows that the FBI doesn't? They try to cover it. I think I still agree with you. Ultimately, it's like kind of doesn't make sense. But she remembered this thing on frontline that she had seen. And in the book, it's just she had heard some story. I don't remember how she gets turned on.
It was like a classmate was working on the case, or like knew somebody who was working on the case.
Yeah, I think just from a filmic point of view, her watching the tape, Gray putting it in, then Fletcher Cole getting a copy of that frontline and then watching it, kind of, and then the tape of Fletcher Cole being in the room where they apparently tape every. There's a lot of tape.
Yeah,
I love that tradecraft, a very analog tape. Also, I guess you can put together a car bomb in 15 minutes when someone's in the bank. That's all. Is that true, Amanda, in your long experience of domestic terrorism? How long does it take you to put a car on a beige Ford Taurus?
Can you still do that in cars that don't have key starters? Is another question.
I don't think so. I also don't think you can use a Slim Jim to get into a digital remote lock. You know, like you just, that old thing you put in there. Mm-hmm. I don't think my 2022 Kia even is susceptible to that kind
of. These are my questions. I'd be a terrible criminal.
Oh, horrible. I would just be so nervous and vomit, and all my cover stories would lie. I would be I'm fascinated by the analog stuff. The reported side, what you can and can't run, I'm still not sure. Mm. What you need double confirmation for, what you don't need it for. I guess the important thing is I lose a little bit the stakes, because once the FBI and Denton Voiles knows that there's something to it, does it really, what is it that Darby and Gray are going to dig up that they never can? Is it just Garcia? Is it just the affidavit from Garcia? I'm not really sure about what's at stake at the end. If they do get blown up in that car bomb, I don't think the investigation of Matisse dies.
That's true. And I don't think the FBI, I don't think the FBI would have too much trouble connecting, like investigating Matisse's lawyers, but they would have trouble pinning the naming of Rosenberg and Jensen on Matisse's lawyers without the memo.
Right. Though weirdly, we don't care about Matisse.
We don't
care about the president's fate in the movie, I think. Right. So there's a little bit of, I don't know if you call it sleight of hand or narrative muddiness that distract us too. Because honestly, if we know they're the heroes, we care about them surviving, then it kind of doesn't matter. Right. Mm-hmm. Like the real football here is, do Darby and Gray get the story? Do they get a byline? Weirdly, in the book, Darby writes the story. Did you catch that in the book? I thought that was a weird choice. I don't understand that. I really always found it gracious that Gray gave her a byline. He has to point it out to her. But in the book, he's like, I got to stay up all night to write this, and I need 3 cups of coffee. And Darby's like, you want me to do it for you? And she's like, I'll get you a typewriter. I don't know what that was about.
For someone who's trying to hide to save her life, putting your name on the story seems weird.
Now we're in nitpick land. Yeah. Let's go. Because I've got a bunch of these. Does Darby have enough money to survive forever in the Caribbean? She gets $200,000 from her dad's death. Is that enough to survive forever in St. Martin? I don't know enough about this. It doesn't feel like enough.
In the 90s? Not forever. I don't know that she is intending to survive forever. But
Oh, she's not in. And then in the movie, she's worried about getting murdered again. That's why she's on the plane. She's like, the Batiste dudes are still going to come after her after all this is over.
That's why she leaves. Yeah.
I mean, it's plausible. I just never really understood. Because in the book, they say the jig is up. Mm-hmm. We're letting everyone go. So we know in the book that she's safe. In the movie, we don't really. It's unclear to me. Like, there's something like, there's a Casablanca element to the end, which I really like. But logically, I'm like, what's going on here exactly? Why are we doing this?
Why couldn't they find you in the Caribbean also? Like, what?
Nitpicks, open questions for you.
Well, that's one of my nitpicks is what makes you think. There's actually a line. I can't remember if it's in the book or the movie when she's trying to run. No, it's in the movie. And Denzel is like, why do you think you can disappear? Yeah. Like, why do you think these people can't find you just because you're in the Caribbean? That doesn't make any sense. And she just doesn't really have any kind of answer for it.
Victor Matisse also lives
right. You're just going closer, you know, which isn't mentioned in the book or in the movie rather. But that's something that the whole time she's trying to get out of the country, which is another thing that ties into my earlier point about like, just let the FBI help you. What's wrong with you? You know,
walk into the embassy and say, here's my brief. Right. And here's an interview I'm giving. If I end up dead tomorrow, like kind of evacuate the utility of killing her, essentially.
Yeah. Right?
Tell the story, get it out there. Also make some copies. That's another thing that I was like, we didn't have, she printed it out and she had floppy disks. Alice goes back to her copies. Mm-hmm. I guess there's no cloud, right? If there's a cloud, she's safe because killing her does nothing. It's on a hard drive somewhere.
I also don't understand.
How many copies there are where the brief is weird. Oh. Like the print copies, how many there were was super strange.
Yeah, I lost track. Sending her best friend to her apartment to get to see, like, I don't know what she was there for, to see if it had been broken into or whatever.
I thought about that too. They don't know what Darby looks like. Doesn't Alice get murdered? Right? Doesn't Alice get murdered because everyone thinks she's Darby, like the unit or the Matisse people?
Oh.
She's a 24-year-old white Tulane student. She gets got right there. She gets black bagged.
100%. Like,
Kamel's there.
It's just a woman in coming into this apartment would automatically die. Or the apartment she's would explode. Darby. There would be like a trigger on the door. Like, why?
Yes.
Why would you do that? And for Darby, who so repeatedly says, I can't explain this to you. I can't show this to you. Everyone who touches this thing dies. You sure did just send her into your house. Like, hello? What?
Not a lot of friends with Darby for good reason, I guess.
No.
She'll just send you into her apartment where you might just die or get shot by an Egyptian assassin.
Yeah.
Played by Stanley Tucci's going to get you, Cynthia Nixon. Seems so absurd.
Like, I couldn't think of a less frightening person to cast as an assassin right now. I couldn't.
I mean, Kamel is the most sophisticated international assassin, we're told. So I guess if you think about sophistication as the hallmark of Stanley Tucci.
That's true.
I kind of want Stanley Tucci's current persona to be like, what's that movie or what's that show with Bill Hader? Where he's in Barry. How about this, where Stanley Tucci plays a version of himself where he's also a for-hire hitman for the urbane and wealthy? I would watch that show. That's a new James Bond.
Is that...
What if Stanley Tucci for James Bond?
That's just like the world's most interesting man from the Dos Equis commercial.
Yes, that's exactly... Well, he's already on the way there. Give him a silencer.
Oh, geez.
And an expense card.
Okay, nitpick.
Anyway.
Biggest one. Yes. The entire parking garage scene. The whole thing. The whole thing. It's just full of deus ex machina after deus ex machina. The dog just randomly... Did you not see that there's a giant guard dog? First of all, it's a guard dog. Like, there's a Doberman in the car that doesn't start barking at you.
He waits a useful amount of time to bark
right.
at her, I was noticing. Yeah.
And then the guy chasing you conveniently plows into the car he planted a bomb in.
Very bad stagecraft from the unit of the Matisse guys. Very, very tough.
Like, I can't... The
one car you can't hit that you just put a bomb in. Hoist on your own Taurus, as Shakespeare, I think, once said.
The whole thing is awful. Why do they go up and down the stairs? No reason. It results in nothing. Like, they run through the up and down the stairs in the parking garage for a while.
Yeah.
That changes zero outcomes. And then they just walk into Lithgow's office covered in dirt. Looking like...
I do like that, where he's worried about them and he's about to call him in.
And then he just walks in.
There he is.
Covered in soot.
Also, bugs, I think, is fascinating. The idea of, like, everything could be bugged. I don't know how hard it is to maintain these things, to put them there. But apparently you can bug everything with stuff you get at Radio Shack. Mm. You know, Kamel's bugging. Everyone's bugging everybody else. A lot. I do like that stagecraft. But I think it's at that level it works. But I agree with you that anytime anyone has to run in this movie, it seems to be out over its skis a little mm-hmm. bit. You know, a little bit like, how are we gonna make this more like The Fugitive? And I think that's the thing I would like. I want a little more lightness. I don't think this is a pulpy thriller. It is not All the President's Men. Mm. Bernstein and Woodward do not need to whisper to each other about everything.
Yeah.
And it's just not that same level of gravitas. A little more fun, a little less male gaze, and give Denzel and Julia time to cook together longer. Those are my notes for it. On the other hand, I will say this. The movie just crushes the book.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely dominates it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Screenwriters are good, it turns out. I think it's up there with Hunt in our discussions of things that are so much better.
Oh, better than the actual book themselves. I would agree with that. I thought you meant just generally as a product, and I was about to come through.
Oh, no Amanda, you know I
was. I was shocked, hence the gasping. No, it is, I would agree. Yes, it is much better than the source material.
As a tribute, so shout out to screenwriters. I think that's one thing I've learned over time is that sometimes, a lot of times the movie's better in the book, especially if you like the movie. If you like the movie, there's a good chance that the screenwriters did something pretty fascinating. And I think Pakula did a wonderful job here with the screenplay, even if I just wish that we weren't quite so like in church talking to each
mm-hmm.
other all the time. Last notes, Amanda, you want to get in before the we submit ourselves to the FBI and get on the plane with no flight plan and get out of here?
No, my last thing on my little piece of paper here is Stanley Tucci in all caps with 4X question marks after it. And I already ranted about that. So
you got that out.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda, thank you so much. That's The Pelican Brief by John Grisham, written and directed by Alan J. Pakula, starring Julia Roberts and the great Denzel Washington. We'll talk to you all next time. There might even be some toil and trouble coming up. I don't want to show my hand or anything at some point in the future. Thanks so much, Amanda.